All right, so we'll start the recording. So just to give a little background, before I went to medical school, I was an engineer. I was an aerospace engineer, started in mechanical engineering, and then I got a job with Boeing. I was at Edwards Air Force Base, which is where I first met Shirley and then eventually Raj. After being an engineer, I thought, you know, this is not really what talents God gave me to be an engineer. Although I was able to do fine, I got mostly A's in my class, I really loved living things in biology. So I prayed about it and decided that medical school and being a doctor was more in line with the talents God gave me. So then I applied to medical school. I got into medical school and graduated, and then went on to do a residency in family medicine. When Raj asked me today to talk about creation, I wanted to explain from my perspective as a doctor what I think. I recall sometimes in residency, people would make comments to me like, isn't it amazing how our bodies evolved over all this time from apes? And I would say, no. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing how complex our bodies were designed perfectly by God? And people would think, wow. I thought it was only ignorant people who didn't understand science who believed that God created the world. I can't believe somebody who's smart could believe that God created the world exactly as he said in the Bible. So I'm going to explain in my talk today a little bit of some of the scientific reasons why I think creation actually fits better than evolution with the world that we see today. There's three concepts that I want you to think about today. One is irreducible complexity. Another is the law of entropy. And then the third one, which...
Turn off your cell phone. That's the third one.
No, I'll get to the third one in a minute in the review. So first one, irreducible complexity. There's this book written by Dr. Michael Behe. He's a biochemistry professor. And he talks about how when we look in biological systems, we see systems that are fully designed, and you can't break them down into these slow, gradual steps. The idea of evolution is that things gradually went from just rocks and water into the incredible complexity of people today by these gradual infinitesimal steps over millions and millions of years. But Michael Behe said in his book, you can't develop a system with these tiny little steps, because for the system to work, everything has to be there at once, and each individual part doesn't provide any benefit, so you have to have everything together. That sounds kind of confusing, so he uses the analogy of a mousetrap. So he says, with a mousetrap, you've got the plate on the bottom, you've got the spring, you've got the lever, you've got the bait, you've got this whole system together, and it can catch a mouse when a mouse tries to grab the cheese. The whole thing snaps on them. But each individual part is of no value at all. So how would you evolve a system where you have a spring and a lever and the center piece and the bait and the bottom piece? So he says all the pieces have to be in place before you can catch any mouse. Any precursor that was missing a crucial part would not function. But natural selection can only choose among systems that are already working. So natural selection doesn't work in the idea of these systems that we see in biology, the systems where everything has to be together in order for it to function at the end. Evolution, the idea is that things gradually change, one tiny step at a time, one single protein mutation. But that really isn't the system that we see. An example in the blood is blood clotting. So, you know, we just take for granted when we get a cut, the cut stops bleeding, right? It's a simple thing, and you know, as a kid, you scratch yourself and you get a scab and you pick it off. It bleeds and it stops, and it just seems like such a simple thing. But when we've analyzed what exactly the blood clotting system involves, is there's 12 different factors, and there's different inhibitory systems. So this is an example showing all those different factors. So it starts with a tear. So you have like surface contact, where you tear the skin, and when it tears through the vessel, there's substances released that cascade all these different factors down. So there's 12 total factors, and at the end you have this blood clot. So each of these factors has 100 and some, like 150, 120 protein sequences. So every one of these factors is hundreds of sequences of protein that the body produces in exactly the right amount, so that when you get a cut, you can form a clot and it'll stop bleeding so you don't bleed to death. Obviously, there's problems. You probably have heard of hemophilia, where a person doesn't clot normally because they're born with this problem and they have to constantly get transfusions of blood clotting factors, otherwise they'll die. So it has to be just perfect so that when you get cut, it stops bleeding. And then as far as if the clot forms too easily, that also causes many, many medical problems. So a heart attack is when you form a clot in your heart and it blocks off the blood and then part of your heart doesn't get blood and dies. A stroke is a blood clot that forms along an artery that's damaged. A deep venous thrombosis, I don't know how many have heard of that. It's like when you ride an airplane, a blood clot's back in your leg, and then the clot starts moving up. If your leg's still too long and bent too long, that blood clot can break loose, get in your lungs, block off the blood. That's called a pulmonary embolus. That can be fatal too. So the system is amazingly complex, and it's in perfect balance. And by the way, if anybody has questions along the way, just ask me. I'm totally happy with making this back and forth. So a bacteria flagella. This is a tiny little whip cord on bacteria that allow them to propel themselves. You could think of it like a propeller on a boat. Bacteria move through liquids, and they have this little motor that spins around, and it drives them through whatever solution they are in order to get to where they want to go to get food, or get away from danger, things like that. So this is a microscopic view of a bacteria flagella. It's actually got a little circular piece of molecules called the rotor, and then there's the stator, the part around the outside that causes this whole thing to spin. There's bushings here, and this looks almost like a machine, doesn't it, for any of you who know what like inside a electric motor, where you've got the windings and you've got the coil, and then there's bearings on each end. And this whole thing spins, and because this is hook-shaped, the flagella on the end is going to spin like this, and it's going to propel it, just like a propeller through the water. So this is an example of irreducible complexity. How would you involve something like this, where you have hundreds of proteins making up the rotor and the stator, so this part spins, and then the bushings that hold it stable, and then this hook-shaped flagella that is the propeller. You have three different things that evolve at once.
Yeah? What's the energy source?
You know, I'm not exactly sure what the energy source is that causes the rotor and the stator. I'm thinking probably ATP. It's been a while since I've had my basic science.
Electrical impulse.
ATP?
What does that stand for?
Oh, it stands for adenine triphosphate. So you have, anyway, it's amazingly complex, but you've got these phosphate molecules that form like 2 and 3, like diphosphate and triphosphate, and that creates the energy. So,
there's a laser pointer on there.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, these systems are so complex that, like, I don't remember all the details of back in the day of chemistry. But I reviewed some of this. So, entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, and this goes back to my engineering. Some of this. Does anybody know about entropy?
If you have kids, you know about entropy.
Yeah, you know about entropy. So the second law of thermodynamics, and a law is something that we see, it's consistent, it's never violated. So the second law of thermodynamics says all things tend to more randomness. Anytime you organize things, it always becomes more random. And we see that. It drives chemical reactions. It basically drives the world. Everything gets old and decays and falls apart. That's how things occur in the world and in the system that we know of. So if you put all molecules together in one place, they disperse and they go until they're randomly distributed in an entire area. So things that are organized become more disorganized. That's how things occur randomly in nature. When things are organized in a certain way, they, over time, become less and less organized. So it's pretty obvious to me from the second law of thermodynamics that's never violated that evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics, right? You're saying you have this disordered randomness where you have rocks and sand and water, and somehow it's going to form together into the incredible complexity that we know of as life. Oh, so here's my third point. Information. Yeah?
I heard someone say about entropy. This was a doctor in Divinity. He said that because of the second law of thermodynamics and entropy, he theorized that Adam and Eve, God created. Of course, he created them perfect. And that no written language was needed back then because they were so smart. They remembered everything. And as time went on, we're kind of getting dumber and dumber because of entropy, but at the same time, we have an increase of the information.
I would agree with that. When you think about, you know, the other thing that evolutionists talk about often is that our DNA has mistakes that we call mutations, and those mutations somehow are going to make us better, but mutations are always worse. You know, it's like you're recopying a book over and over and over, and you make mistakes, and you make mistakes, and you make mistakes. Every one of those mistakes comes up with a disease, and probably most of you know somebody that has something like cystic fibrosis. That's a mistake in the gene that prevents some of the sodium chloride channels from working right. There's all kinds. Like I recall back in medical school learning hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of genetic diseases that are all mutations. So Adam and Eve had perfect genetics. And they had random variation that makes all the people we see today. They had all that genetics within them. And over time, there's more and more mistakes in genetics. So people aren't getting better, smarter. Like evolution would say, people are getting dumber and more mistakes, more mutations. You know, obviously our technology is together.
Good evidence for that as well as our genome getting weaker is the fact that many centuries ago, we used to be able to marry our sisters with limited, you know, issues. Mm-hmm. And then it was cousins. And to this point now, it's very, very likely that if you marry your cousin or something like that, you will have kids with major deformities. So each time someone dies, it actually takes part of the gene pool with them.
Could this be one of the reasons why we have so many autoimmune diseases?
Yeah, I think so too. The immune system, which I'm not going to talk about the immune system, but it's amazing that it's able to pick up and know exactly what's a foreign enemy and what's not and fight it off and not attack the body. But autoimmune disease, when your body thinks that part of you is actually a foreign invader.
Couldn't a person who believes in evolution say, yeah, entropy, that's right, but then God intervened miraculously and made it go backwards, like the resurrection? That's the opposite.
Well, obviously, God made a system with all this information to start with, and I think God can reverse entropy if he chooses to. If you recall, when the children of Israel wandered in the desert for 40 years, it says their clothes didn't wear out. So can you imagine that? Everybody's clothes, day after day after day, didn't wear out. God miraculously stopped entropy for that one factor because they didn't have the supply of clothes. So God stopped that for 40 years. Their clothes didn't wear out at all. So information... can be facts learned. We all know what that type of information. But the one I want to talk about is information that's conveyed or represented by arrangement or sequence of things, genetically transmitted information. So that's really what we see in the world. We see a world that has this incredible amount of information, and that information is stored in the DNA and the part that makes us who we are as humans. So DNA, for anybody that studied it, that's what stores most of our genetic information about who we are, and we get part of it from each parent, and that combination together makes who we are as a person. And it's a fairly simple molecule and a fairly simple information source, but it's extremely dense with information. To give you an idea how dense it is, so 1 gram of DNA holds 455 exabytes of data. There's 1 billion gigabytes in an exabyte. So you know what a gigabyte is, right? The cloud computing company estimated there's 1.8 zezabytes of data in the world in 2011. So it would take 4 grams or about a teaspoon of DNA to hold everything from Plato through the complete works of Shakespeare to Beyoncé's latest album, not to mention every brunch photo ever posted on Instagram. So this system that God uses to store data on DNA is incredible. One single teaspoon can hold all of the information that humankind has ever amassed through our writings. How much information is in a body? So there's 100 trillion cells in the human body. That's just an incredible number that's hard to comprehend. 100 trillion. When you think there's 7 billion people on the world, there's more cells in one person's body by far, by 1,000 times, than all the people in the entire world. Your body makes 200 billion red blood cells every day. So every single day, your body makes more blood cells than the entire population of the entire world. And every one of those blood cells is a complex structure that has hundreds and hundreds of base pairs that are going through your body, carrying the oxygen, doing what you need to do to live. You lose 40,000 skin cells every minute. So it's just, to me, it's just unbelievable how complex our bodies are. Each of our kidneys have 1 million nephrons, and those kidneys have all these complex tasks of balancing the sodium, potassium, the blood sugar, the pH. Your kidneys are, there's a saying that they say that the dumbest kidney is smarter than the smartest first-year resident from medical school. So when you're trying to figure out what's the body doing here, why is it doing this or that, you know, our kidneys are doing all this stuff in the background while we're doing whatever else we want to do, but in an incredible way. So each biceps muscle that a person has 250,000 muscle fibers. So I figured I'd show a little picture of the skin, because we're losing 30,000 cells every minute. And what happens is with skin is you have these squarish cells that gradually become flattened as they grow up. They lose their nucleus. They reach the surface, and the surface of your skin is like this dead seal. I think about the skin, it's like a package of meat with a cellophane cover. That's kind of how our bodies are. And as long as that cellophane cover is intact, we do pretty well. But if your skin dries out too much, it'll get cracks and you'll start to itch. So I guess as a doctor, I know a lot about what goes wrong with stuff. So here's a picture of the kidney. Remember, we have a million of these nephrons, every single person in each kidney. So you got 2 million because you got one in each side. And this reminds me a little bit of an oil filter. You know how in an engine you have this oil filter that's constantly cleaning your oil, so when it circulates through your body, the your blood is nice and pure. And the kidney does that through these concentrating systems. It also balances out the pH. So pH has to do with the acid base. The pH of any of us in this room is 7.4. It's always 7.4, exactly 7.4. And anybody that has a pool knows that pH like goes all over the place with the pool. You add this, you add that. Our bodies maintain exactly the right pH because that keeps all the proteins in our body working the way they should. So, I always think these are pretty cool. A lot of people don't know that we've got these things. They're called the Golgi tendon organ. Probably nobody here has heard of a Golgi tendon organ. But the Golgi tendon organ allows us not to rupture our muscles. I'm sure most people have cooked a steak, right? Sliced through it. Steak is like incredibly weak, isn't it? I'm just amazed how soft that muscle is, like if you cut it before you cook it. Yeah. Steak is like so weak. And you think, why don't people rip muscles a lot? Because muscles are so incredibly weak. Like when you go lift something. Well, the reason is because God built into our muscles this thing called a Golgi tendon organ. So there's a nerve that goes up into the tendon at the end of each muscle in our body, and that nerve travels all the way back to the spinal cord, right where the muscle is where the nerve is that causes the muscle to contract. So within every muscle and tendon of our body, we've got these sensors, and they sense, is the muscle about to rip? And if it is about to rip, then it causes the nerve that's telling you to contract that muscle to relax. So if I go to lift a weight that my muscle's about to tear, it'll just relax the muscle. It'll bypass my brain that's telling me, lift that muscle. It's going to say, relax the muscle. So it prevents me from lifting something that would otherwise rip the muscle. Yeah, it's a safety feedback. When you think about it, how would something like this evolve? Well, you've got a whole system of nerves that run all the way through the body that are wired in such a way that causes this muscle to relax when it's pulled. And often injuries we see, like the classic is the when somebody gets rear-ended in a car crash and they get whiplash in their neck. The reason that occurs is that there's a certain time the electricity has to flow from the Golgi tendon through the nerve to cause this to relax. A car accident happens so fast that that muscle's tight before the loop can come to cause that muscle to relax, because the impact is so abrupt and harsh, then this muscle actually rips. So that when you get a whiplash injury from a car accident, you actually rip the muscle because the relaxing phase can't occur that fast. And rarely in nature do we have that. So we have these systems of cars and crashes that put our bodies in a system that isn't what you normally see in nature. So the human eye, our eyes are incredibly complex like everything else. Once we start to investigate it, we've got the pupil. There's a lens in the front that focuses back on the retina in the back. There's a solid clear fluid in the back. There's a liquid in front called the vitreous humor. And then there's muscles that cause the lens to perfectly form. There's all the layers around the eye, and you think, how would something like this evolve? You know, you've got this incredibly complex system where all of it has to work at once. And as far as the chemical reaction that occurs, I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. But the retina, you know, we think of the retina, that's the back part of the eye that receives the light, as just like a camera. You know how a camera, you just have a sensor, the light hits it, it makes an image, right? Well, our retinas aren't like that. The retina actually analyzes the image. It compresses, which I think it's on my next slide, it compresses the data, and it actually breaks some of the data down. So it looks for movement, and it actually isolates that. It looks for angles and corners. I don't know how many of you know about how computers compress things, probably. So the way a computer compresses like an image, there's way too much data there. So people have written programs that compress the data. They look at things and they, like, for instance, if you took a square of this room, it would look at that wall and say, oh, that's yellow, and then it looks at the next pixel and it says, well, that's the same color yellow and the same color yellow. So it compresses it into a small set instead of defining each pixel exactly. And our retina actually does that same type of a thing. So these are the chemical reactions in vision. Light hits the cell, hits the rod cell, and it isomerizes retinol, then rhodopsin converts to metarhodopsin 2, then metarhodopsin 2 activates transducent, which activates phosphodiesterase, which phosphodiesterase hydrolyzes cyclic GMP. Cyclic GMP is scarce, so the sodium channels close and the membranes hyperpolarize and electrical impulse is sent to the brain. So you don't just have some simple thing.
Just pop up.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gary. Which one of those is messed up in my eye?
So in macular degeneration is entropy. That's basically what the problem is, disorder. The body's not fixing and healing itself as fast as it should. So all the chemicals are fine. It's just that the retina starts to break down. So the retina, again, it compresses the data by 100 times because there's so much data coming into your brain that data stream would overwhelm the computing capacity. So God built our retina to compress that data. And you don't realize that. The other thing you don't realize is that the retina and the lens and the iris are adjusting how bright the light is. With cameras today, people don't understand it as much, but I remember back in the day when I was younger, when you take a picture, you had to adjust the f-stop and have a light meter. And you take this picture, it would be like super dark, and you think, why is that? You know, I looked at it with my eye, it looked fine. I took the picture, it's all messed up. Or take a picture outside, it's all washed out and too bright because you didn't adjust the f-stop and all this other stuff that the old cameras have. Everything's automatic now because it basically does what our eye does. Our eye adjusts the amount of light that comes in through the iris, plus all the retina, it enhances and it adjusts that image. The retina helps with detecting movement, so that with the retina and the eye together and the brain, we can see that there's movement. And we just take that for granted, right? So there's a condition which I like to talk a little about, problems that go wrong. You probably haven't heard of this, akinetopsia. That's where people can't see movement. So it's actually a medical condition that a stroke and some different problems in the retina can occur, where a person can't see movement. And, you know, when you see something your whole life, you can't imagine what it would be like without that, without being able to see movement. but you have to process one image to the next comparison to see movement. It's obviously that if you can't see movement, you can't drive, right? You have to lose your driver's license because you can't go down the road and not know if a car is moving or not. You also can't really cross the street unless you trust all the lights because you can't see if the car there is stopped or if it's moving. So there is a condition where people cannot perceive motion in their visual field despite the ability to see stationary objects without issue. So that's, again, another process of the retina.
Is that an eye image or a brain image?
You mean it's a both. It can be the eye, but it's also the brain and the processing and the two interacting.
I read something recently about how the eye, as the eyes feed the information into the brain, how the brain is doing a massive amount of work looking through going through the recesses of your brain to try to, or not try, but actually to interpolate or to analyze what it actually sees. It gives decisions that this is close, this is far, this is, you know, all the different things. But then we didn't realize it's happening. It's just amazing calculations that can be done all day, even if you realize it's going on.
Yeah, it's incredible how that whole system is, and it's obvious.
It's tricky. You know, things that the brain would say, this is actually here. You do an optical illusion. The brain looks at it and says, no, that's far away. But you show that by, like, making a train track. You see a train track, say, gone. It should get narrow, narrow, narrow. But they make a train track go the opposite direction. And fools the brain. Like, wait, what's going on here? The brain's going through this analysis, you know, analysis, and it's not matching up.
And if you ever look at the moon right when it comes up, it always looks bigger than when it's up in the sky because your eye and your brain make it seem bigger because it's right on the horizon. You can compare it. When it's by itself alone in the sky, you can't. So the ear, a couple things I wanted to point out. One is the tensor tympani muscle and the stapedius muscle, smallest muscle in the body. You think, here's the system. So here's the drum. Sound comes in. It causes this to push on the on the malleus, which then pushes on the incus, which then pulls on the stapedius in this part, and then this goes on to send a signal about how much sound there is. And anybody with hearing aids? Yeah. So you notice what hearing aids make everything loud, especially the background noise. It makes it harder to hear in a room, especially if there's background noise. You wonder, why is that? Well, it's because our ear has all this processing where it gets rid of noise. And it focuses on the signal. Like in a crowded room, it's really hard if you have hearing aids because hearing aids don't do that as much. Although the newer hearing aids, they actually put a little computer chip that does some of the algorithms that we think our body actually does. And then these two muscles, this tensor tympani muscle and the stapedius muscle, what they do is they pull against those bones so that if you have this loud sound, they pull against the bones and then less sound comes through. So if you've ever been exposed to like loud sounds for a while and then you suddenly go into a quiet room, everything is hard to hear and it's hard to hear people, it's because these muscles are pulling tight on the bones and they're not letting much sound through. And so that helps protect us from hearing loss. So
I know that when we're fellowshipping in the kitchen between services and there's a lot of people talking, especially your voice. Your voice is so low, it drowns with everything else. I can't hear anything. Is that something wrong with my hearing? Because when everything's silent, you're the only one talking, you can whisper. I can hear you.
Yeah. Well, it has to do, too. Low voices have less energy. It has to do with the physics. The higher the pitch, the more energy in the voice and the easier it is to transmit. So low voices, I have a somewhat low voice. It's harder to hear. And so I have to speak louder. All right, so I was going to talk briefly about the semicircular canals. They're in the three axes, X, Y, and Z axis, for anybody that knows a grid system, and they're what allows us to maintain our balance. And inside, you've got all these nerve cells, and then there's a layer of nerves that stick up like this, and then you've got this called the otochondria. There's these heavy calcium crystals, so that when you move forward, the nerve bends, and that tells us whether you're accelerating or not. So when you go on a ride, you know how they tip the rides and you get virtual reality? It's because we have this system that's built into our bodies with all these three different semicircular canals. And this is also an example of irreducible complexity. How would you build a system with these three canals in three different axes is perfectly lined up with hair cells inside with this heavy calcium on top that bends whenever we move that keeps our balance. I want to talk just a little about genetics. So what we see of change in the world and people interpret as evolution is a realignment of the information that's there. It's not new information, it's realignment of the existing information. God built a system that's incredibly resilient and adjustable, and it allows an incredible amount of variation. The field of genetics started with Gregor Mendel, who was a monk at a monastery in Austria, and he noticed how these pea plants in his garden would vary based on which other parent plants they had. So he figured out, based on the parents, if you had the yellow pea and you had the green pea and the white pea and the wrinkled and the smooth, if you mix those together, you ended up with all these different types of peas at the end. It's because you have this information that God put in the system, and when the two different parents get together and rearrange their DNA, you get all these different varieties. This is not evolution. This is natural variation, which occurs within a species. And that's what people see, and then they extrapolate that into saying that's what evolution is. So anybody know about corn? So corn started out as this little bitty kind of a grass thing, and it had all the genetic information of this big corn thing. In fact, the variation within the wild type is not as much as within this modern corn. They've selected certain gene variations, and they've been able to produce by selectively breeding. So the corn started out as this little one, then they got bigger corn, and finally the great big corn that we see today. But that information is not new information. It's just reassembling the existing information that was in the DNA of the corn all along that God put there. Here's a graph showing the U.S. corn yields. Back in 1875, corn would be about 20 bushel the acre, and you see how it was pretty much constant until about 1925, a 20 bushel to the acre of corn. And I grew up from the Midwest, so I saw corn all the time. And corn today, you know, a corn plant in a mature field is at least as tall as the ceiling, if not taller. It's somewhere around 8 to 9 feet tall. And the corn plants are planted about 3 inches apart, and it's incredible to see those fields of corn. But you look at this. Today, it's not uncommon to get 160 to 180 bushels of corn produced per acre of corn in the Midwest. And the biggest problem is, how do you sustain a price when you produce so much corn? So now in the Midwest, there's all these alcohol plants. For anybody that's been there, there's alcohol plants like all over the place. Last year, they turned enough corn into alcohol to feed 500 million people from corn in the United States. So, you know, the world doesn't have a shortage of food right now. It's a shortage of distribution and wars and all those other kind of things. But there's enough food to feed 500 million people, and it was made into alcohol in the United States last year alone. So dogs are a good example.
Could you go back to that? Mm-hmm. What happened in 1925? What happened?
What happened to make this giant? It had to do with the agronomy research around hybridization. If you know about hybridization,
they started to figure out,
rather than just selective breeding, they actually use hybridizing, where you breed two different things.
One of the things was the development of pedology, soil production, where they could get a higher yield out of the table.
Right. They also, the Haber process, you guys know who Haber was at all? Anyway, he was this Jewish scientist in Germany who developed the mustard gas and stuff like that. In fact, he was really big on watching as they put the mustard gas on people. Anyways, he also figured out how to turn natural gas into anhydrous ammonia, which is injected into the corn. So to make good corn yields, you need lots of nitrogen in the soil. You need lots of, it's called the Haber process, by the way. Anyway, that's kind of a sidelight. But so the hybridization, where they had hybrids. If you've seen like seed corn fields, what they do is they plant one kind of corn and they plant another kind of corn, and then they mow off all the tassels on the one kind that they don't want, and then it crosses with the other, and it makes these corns and these companies. There's a whole lot, like the GMO, you may have heard of that, genetically modified, that's part of it too, where they have corn that makes pesticides that kill the bugs that chew on it. So, I mean, it's a pretty...
So was something published right around that time that everybody started to read, and then they go, oh yeah,
well, it's the corn seed company started making tons of money and started dominating with research. All right, so dogs. I'm sure you've seen all kinds of dogs, like, yeah, Gary?
What's the name of that stuff that they're putting in all the food now that everybody's protesting because it's not good for us, supposedly?
Well, I think that's a genetically modified, the GMOs, genetically modified. So there's, like, I don't know if you know, like Roundup. You've heard of Roundup herbicide, right? You buy it, you spray it, kills everything, right? Well, they figured out there are certain plants that have a gene that can process Roundup and get rid of it. So they've hooked that gene into the corn gene so that you can spray Roundup on a cornfield and it absolutely kills every weed. So if you go to Midwest today, like when I was a kid, they'd hire high school students to go hoe in the cornfields because there's all kind of weeds growing in the cornfields. But today they have this Roundup Ready corn, so the Roundup gene is in the corn and it resists Roundup. You can spray Roundup on the corn and that field is absolutely without a single weed. It's just corn and soil and that's it.
So, that's real good for us, right?
I have my doubts. The other thing is, like with fruit, for instance, if you take like the native fruit that's more the wild type, it tends to have more vitamins and nutrients and minerals. Then people select, like for peaches, they select bigger and bigger and juicier and sweeter, and it gets more sugar, but it actually has less nutrients. So I think in a lot of ways, that original corn plant was probably better for us than the current one. So anyways, there's certainly a lot of problems when it comes to our current diet, but I'm kind of getting a little off track. So dogs. The dogs, there was original ancestor. I'm not sure if it was really a gray wolf or if God created the dog type from the beginning, but all dogs came from probably just one ancestor that had this, again, incredible genetic variation. If you've seen a Chihuahua, they're like this big, you know, you can hold them in your hand. And then there's the Bull Mastiff that are 180, 200 pounds. They're all from one dog kind. But God built into the dog kind this incredible variation of genetics so that people could choose and get certain types. If you recall, there's some description of Jacob in the Bible about how there was the spotted sheep and the sheep that were white, and he figured out some of the genetics so that within Laban's flock, when Laban says, you can have this kind of sheep, he figured out how to make the sheep breed more of that type and less of the other type. So people have figured this out for years, and most dogs have been bred for hundreds and hundreds of years for different purposes like hunting and killing rats and things like that. So liger, you guys know what a liger is?
No.
So a liger is a combination of a lion and a tiger. They can actually interbreed. We think of a lion and tiger as being totally different, but they probably came from one cat kind on the ark. And the largest, this is a liger, which is the largest cat. It's actually bigger than a lion or a tiger together. But
it's monodirectional too, right? It's like a male lion and a female tiger, and it doesn't work the other way, right?
Yeah, I forget which way. It's one direction, but that's what a liger is. So we think of a lion and tiger as different, but they probably started as one cat kind, and God put the genetics together. So how about a kiwoof? Have you ever heard of a kiwoof? See, I'd never heard of it, and I was reading the newspaper like a couple years ago, and apparently there was a jogger on the East Coast that was killed by this pack of kiwoofs. So kiwoofs are a male coyote, or actually it's a male wolf and a female coyote make a kiwoof. And the kiwoof is kind of between a coyote and a wolf. So they also, I think, are the same kind. It just have the genetic variation to make what's halfway in between. So that's
a Buell is what?
Okay, Ross. So a mule is a female horse and a male donkey make a mule, right? But a female donkey and a male horse make a hinny. This is a matrix here that shows what each of them make, and a donkey and a horse. They have different chromosomes so that a mule is sterile. But mules are really tough. They use them for, they're strong and tough, and they use them for packing. So rocks and water, that to me is not what makes the incredible complexity of what we see in nature. If you think about an analogy, analogies always break down, but in my mind, the analogy of our body is closest to like a computer. You have all these different parts. You have a CPU, a fan, a sound card, video card, motherboard, the case. You put all this stuff together, and then you have a computer that's functioning and does what it needs to do. Our bodies are a lot like that. But I don't go to the stream, if I go back to the stream and get rocks and water and think I'm going to build a computer, right? I go to the computer store and I buy all these parts. And I don't buy Mac parts for my IBM PC. I buy PC parts. That's how our bodies are, this incredible, complex part. So at last I added a little section on measuring time because people say, well, if the world is millions of years, how could things evolve? When we measure time, like in an hourglass, we have to know what the initial condition, how much sand was there when it started, is the rate constant or is the rate change, and then what the current conditions are. And honestly, the only one we know for sure is the current condition. You've heard of carbon-14 dating, right? This thing is dated by carbon dating. And basically, cosmic rays bombard the air. They turn nitrogen into carbon, and that carbon gets incorporated into living tissue. When the tissue dies, then you can measure how much carbon-14 is left. Carbon-14 dating is only fairly recent. It can date maybe 10,000 years. They try to go beyond that, but it really only dates a short amount of time. It assumes constant conditions. So if there was a time where there was more vegetation, it would make things appear older because the carbon-14 coming in is constant and it's distributed over a larger amount of tissue. Therefore, things would appear much older. So the world before the flood probably had much more vegetation, and that's why anything that dated then would also have a much different carbon-14 dating. It also assumes equilibrium, that the amount of carbon-14 produced is constant and it's equally distributed in the entire world. So the only way to make that assumption is assume the Earth is billions of years old, which it's not. You've also probably heard about radioactive age dating of rocks, where they look at how much uranium is in a rock, and then over time that uranium turns to lead. And when they measure the amount of lead, they say, well, this rock is so many millions of years old. But it's assuming that when the rock was newly formed, it was all uranium, which is an assumption that may or may not be correct. It's my opinion, it's not correct at all, that God created the rock with uranium and with lead. The other thing it assumes is that the rate of decay is constant, which God could have changed the rate of decay at any time, and it would make things appear to be much different. The other thing that's commonly used, which is index fossils, completely circular argument, they'll look at a rock and say, well, this particular fossil is a million years old, therefore the rock's a million years old. So you make up this column here, which is what scientists did, and then they identified all these fossils, and they said, if you ever see this fossil, that rock is 400 million years old. But that's completely circular argument. There's nothing that dated other than what somebody said. And I saw the article recently. This was in Smithsonian Magazine, May of 2006, where they found soft tissue in a dinosaur bone. And soft tissue obviously breaks down, so there was some broken up blood cells and some cartilage within a dinosaur bone that supposedly is millions and millions of years old. And the scientists say, well, it's just amazing how that got preserved. But to me, it's amazing how this is a more recent, dinosaurs are not millions and millions of years old. So I believe that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, just like he says in Genesis 1:1. So any other questions?
Well, would any evolutionist disagree with anything you showed us? Probably not.
Well, here's the thing is, I believe that evolution is more of like a belief system where people have faith and they don't care about the evidence, honestly. They have decided already how things are, and so they look at things from their perspective and spin things however they want. And then within the scientific establishment, if I say believe in creation, I'm not going to get hired at most colleges except a Christian college. I'm going to be ostracized. None of the data that I create, no matter how scientifically valued, is going to get published.
I heard an excerpt from an evolution conference one time where the speaker said, well, we know, it's almost a direct quote, well, we all know there's a lot of problems with evolution, but what's the alternative? Creation?
Yeah. Right, right.
That's the way they look at it.
Yeah, it's not acceptable. Yes, Stephanie?
When you read any scripture, but especially when it talks about Christ healing people, and you know the body so well, what goes through your mind when you think about what happens when he heals them just with a word?
Yeah, it's, you know, I can think about how things are just repaired. You know, it's not like we often heal things in kind of a lame-o way, you might say. So, like, you remember when the lady had that issue of blood for years, and if you go into a doctor now, they do a hysterectomy, they just cut the whole uterus out, right? But God healed her uterus so that it was working like it should, you know? So, you know, she probably could have babies after that and things like that. Obviously, there's places where people can, but the master of the machine can obviously fix the machine with no problem at all, with just a word. But I see sometimes, too, I see old people and I think, wow, if only entropy could be reversed and people could be back to how they are young. And the only way that's going to occur is you know, through death and through the new heaven and the new earth.
So my question for you, Dave, Karen mentioned something earlier where she said, you know, what if a person said, oh, this evolutionary process, God must have intervened here because that would be impossible. God must have intervened here. Why don't you hold to a theistic evolution?
So I'd say the reason I don't hold to theistic evolution is not so much the science part, but the fact, like Paul says, through sin, sin entered the world through one man, and salvation entered through one man, Christ. So, you know, how would the apes go from ape to ape to ape to ape, and suddenly it becomes Adam, and then Adam sinned? That doesn't make sense to me. The other thing is, when God created, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and God said it was good. It was very good. And there wasn't all this death and struggle, and the fossil record shows evolution is death, struggle, survival of the fittest. And that doesn't make sense to me with Genesis, the perfect world in Eden.
So when you go to Genesis chapter 1 and the 6 days of creation, do you believe that to be a literal 24-hour day, or?
So I believe it is. You know, the when you study the ancient Hebrew, it seems to be the same word they would use for a regular day. So in my mind, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Obviously, I think it is a literal 24-hour day, because I think God made time. I don't think time existed before God started the creation clock ticking. Why he chose 24-hour days, I don't know. God could have made it in a millisecond. God didn't need that much time, because, you know, the 300 trillion cells that make us, if we tried to build something with 300 trillion cells, that would take us a long, long time. I remember hearing that a 747 has a million parts. It's like the most one of the most complex things humans build. A million parts, and think it takes months and months and months to build that, and if you count all the subparts, even a lot more. But yet God made this world with humans that have 100 trillion cells. He made them and all the other animals on day 6. So God could have done it like that if he wanted to, but he chose to do it over a day. Why he did, it's, you know, God.
In relationship to time, some of the things that were created were spoken into existence as opposed to being actually.
Right. Well, I think, you know, that you think about the size of the universe, too. I mean, it's just incredibly massive, the size of the universe. God spoke that into existence. And there's this thought of, how could the light have gotten these vast distances to? That's a whole nother talk of, you know, how the light could have traveled from millions of light years. God, obviously, when he says in the Bible he created the light first and then the stars, he could have done that. And for anybody who studied a little about relativity, the Einstein's theory of relativity, time is not a constant. The constant supposedly is the speed of light. So God could have changed time as he wills and as he wants to be able to make that light there. If you recall, also it talks in the Old Testament twice where God actually made the sun go backwards. Once it stopped, like Joshua in a battle, and then another time when a king prayed to see God's whether he was going to live, God made the sun go backwards. So think, how would you do that? If you stop the earth, the surface of the Earth is moving at 1,000 miles an hour. It's about 24,000 miles in circumference, and it turns around once every day. All the water in the ocean, if you stopped the Earth, just stopped it, would slosh out, and it would wash over the entire world, because this 1,000-mile-an-hour water that's 6 miles deep is going to... So God did something with time to stop time, and at the same time, you know, didn't have to deal with... So, you know, for God, it's like nothing, because God is truly all-powerful.
Oh. Do you remember about 30 years ago, there was a TV series with a scientist, and I think it was called Cosmos?
Sagan.
Talk about the bias of scientists. It was amazing. I remember him saying in one of those series that if you investigate, you have to investigate all possibilities of what's causing something.
Right. Yeah, don't investigate that.
Right, even if it's the most logical, and even if you like call it intelligence design, you know, where you try to get away from the term of God, which scientists in general don't like. Yeah.
And scientists such as Hugh Ross, who believe in creation, you just never really hear of them very much unless you look around for them and what they write.
There's actually quite a few different scientists who, when they've discovered that, when other scientists have discovered that they believe in creation, they get fired or they don't get promoted, because there's this incredible bias within science. It's you know, science is supposedly without bias, and it just looks at the facts and it makes an investigation. But scientists are humans, and humans are biased. And within the scientific community, there's a whole, like, an overarching pressure to believe in evolution that's like pervasive everywhere. And it's not based on facts, it's based on this culture. Yeah, it's faith, really.
What about the fossils? There's no fossil, right? That shows like a half, like,
yeah, intermediate stages.
Yeah. I think the overwhelming thing isn't so much that they have to believe in evolution, the overwhelming thing is to get funded.
And if you look at like studies, people always say, because this will show us how we got there, like why to go to space, why send a spacecraft so that we can figure out how the world got created or evolved, not created. So it's amazing how scientists always tag that on and they can get funded.
Devil's advocate moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I don't think it's fair to say that the evolutionists only believe this because they want to exclude God from the picture. I think that is some people, Richard Dawkins, some people mm-hmm. that are very anti-God, atheists. I think that there's a lot of evidence that is difficult to explain with a, let's say, young Earth type perspective. There's nucleosynthesis, which is basically, you know, the world is, or the universe is created, and the most complex atomic species or elements, like uranium, the really, really heavy stuff, you would expect that in the fusion processes of the sun and all the stars, that your lightest elements, hydrogen, would be most abundant. And as you went down to the heavier species, you would see the heaviest species being the most rare, which is what we see in our universe and in our soil. Okay, that taken in a parallel to the fact that the stars are so far away that there's this distance, the fact that we have meteor impacts, three of which have been shown that those meteor impacts would be world-ending, like full life on Earth completely destroyed, and there's several of them. Those taken into conjunction are difficult to explain. Why would God, and here's the mm-hmm. argument from them, why would God make it so hard for us to not see the Earth as young if the Earth was in fact young? Like, why did he make it difficult?
Yeah.
Why did he make the evidence show that it's with a lot of age? And so that's where a lot of scientists or people have trouble with this young Earth perspective, is the evidence really does show that it's really old, or at least built with age, right? God created it mm-hmm. with age. And so that's the question. That's the big question that starts a lot of people down that road that, okay, well, if the earth is really, really in fact old, then could God have created evolutionary processes to get us where we are now? And that's where the whole theistic evolution perspective comes from, that the fact we are old. What you mentioned about light, it's fantastic because if you were to change the speed of light, you can, in fact, change the speed of biological processes, right? Because we're talking about gravitational forces and versus all the others. So you have a bit strong and weak electromagnetic, strong and weak atomic, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have that whole group. Those are dependent on the speed of light, whereas your gravitational forces, the rotation of the Earth, that's not. So if you actually were... Sorry. There is evidence, I believe. I could go on for hours, but there is evidence to suggest that you could maintain both perspectives, that there's directed evolution, meaning it's not a random natural thing occurring, but more directed, where God is basically saying, this form, now this form, now this form, over a period of time, which there's this 24-hour period, God decided to use some not blink of an eye thing. So there's needs to be an effort by Christians to explore and create new mm-hmm. science versus always being on the outset and saying, evolution is stupid, and here's the reasons why it's wrong. We need to be going out and making our own evidence for why we believe creation exists. And you pointed out three very, very good things in the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know?
So a couple things I'd say about that. One is, I don't know how many know that the Greeks believed in evolution. Yeah, so the Greeks believed that the world just kind of came here gradually over time, but they had no idea about science. And I think it's a theme that's been in the world ever since the beginning of the world that Satan's actually used to make God not appear. And people in the Middle Ages, you probably heard of spontaneous generation, where people believed that if you put like old rags and grain that it became a mouse, and then they said, well, that doesn't work, but bacteria spontaneously come from dirt. And Pasteur proved that life comes from life. Life does not come from non-life. So people have believed these things for years, and the driver has not been their logical thought of how things occurred. Instead, their thoughts are more of a rebellious one against God. So I think back about the world after before the flood. Adam lived 900 years, right? So anybody born after his time could go and talk to him, and he'd say, this is what happened. God made me. This is the world. So there was no doubt that in the world before the flood, people could go and talk to Adam, and he would tell them exactly what happened. And after he died, there was people that he talked to all the way until the flood, because the flood was probably, if you do the genealogy, around 1,600 years. So there was people who knew Adam all the way to the end of the flood who actually physically talked to him. And yet the world was incredibly wicked. God destroyed the entire earth except for the eight people?
Yeah.
Trying to think. Noah has three sons and their wives and his wife. So it said that, or God said that all the people's inclination was only evil all the time. So it's obvious that knowing the truth about creation doesn't make a person become loyal to God, knowing that God is there. And when the Bible talks about in the Garden of Eden, God stuck these cherubim that guarded Eden, I believe that Eden was there and after the flood it was destroyed. But can you imagine being able to walk to a certain place and seeing an angel with a flaming sword? Wouldn't you think, gosh, I better figure out that how I should live according to God? But yet people, all their inclination was always evil all the time. So believing in evolution, believing in creation doesn't necessarily, I would say if people were convinced of creation, doesn't necessarily mean that they would be good, because people, they knew. It was obvious. And as a kid, I thought, if God's real, why doesn't he just appear here? That's a question probably every kid has always asked. But when I look at the world, I see this incredibly complex, wonderful place, and yet there's this horrible evil and little kids die and people commit horrid crimes and kill other people. So it really fits with the Bible, but God wants us to have faith, even though we don't physically see God. So.
Good. Let's give Dave a hand. Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, so what we're going to do, last week we talked about presuppositions and the fact that people don't approach life neutrally. People are either have the right presuppositions or wrong ones. We also talked about just assumptions that we make about IM. And today Dave shared with us some information. What we're going to do next week is we're going to actually just read through Genesis 1 and 2. And we're going to say, what does the Bible say? Because the issue, one of the things we talked about last week is, whatever God says, God knows. So God's always right. So then the question is, does the Bible say that God made us, that the earth was created in six 24-hour days? Or does it leave room for lots of time? So that's what we'll be looking at next week on Father's Day.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.